From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, journalist Robert Bryce, author of Cronies, Oil, the Bushes, and the Rise of Texas, America's Superstate. The book traces how Texas politicians and corporations have taken leading roles in America's energy policy and foreign policy, including the Iraq War. Also, we talk with cartoonist Bruce Eric Kaplan, better known to readers of The New Yorker as B.E.K., which is how he signs his cartoons. He's also an executive producer of the HBO series 6 Feet Under. He has a new collection of cartoons. And book critic Maureen Corrigan recommends a few novels to read this summer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. An interim report from the 9/11 Commission has found no credible evidence that Iraq and al-Qaeda cooperated on attacks against the U.S. That statement comes as the Commission wraps up its last 2 days of hearings and prepares to issue its final report. NPR's Mary Louise Kelly has more.
The Commission's finding that there's no evidence of collaboration between Saddam Hussein's regime and al-Qaeda is a politically charged one. Just this week, Vice President Dick Cheney asserted that Saddam had, quote, long-established ties with al-Qaeda. That was one of the administration's original reasons for going to war in Iraq. The 9/11 panel says bin Laden did explore possible cooperation with Iraq and that an Iraqi intelligence officer met with bin Laden in 1994. But the panel concludes that the contacts don't appear to have resulted in a collaborative relationship. Mary Louise Kelly, NPR News, Washington.
Attacks on Iraq's oil pipelines have shut down all exports from the country's southern oil fields. Assassins also killed a top official with one of Iraq's two state-owned oil companies. NPR's Emily Harris reports from Baghdad.
Most of Iraq's oil exports go through the south, so this blow is particularly devastating. Officials estimate it could take just a few days to resume pumping at partial capacity, but complete repairs may take longer. Iraq's Prime Minister Iyad Alawi has said more than 100 attacks on the oil industry infrastructure in the past 7 months have cost the country $200 million in lost revenue. That's only a small fraction of the $5 billion exports have earned Iraq so far this year. Analysts say Iraq is capable of producing more oil than it did before the war, but attacks set progress back. Not only pipes and pumping stations are at risk, the oil official assassinated in Kirkuk was at least the third to be targeted over the past year. Emily Harris, NPR News, Baghdad.
The State Department says U.S. officials are helping Saudi Arabia in the effort to find and rescue an American held hostage by Saudi militants. Spokesman Richard Boucher said the U.S. has investigators and resources in the Saudi kingdom.
Saudi Arabian authorities have a lead in the investigation. They can certainly count on the United States to give them any assistance they might need in doing that. But our goal is to try to help secure his release and his safe return to his loved ones as soon as possible.
Boucher said U.S. experts are trying to determine the authenticity of a videotape that purports to show the hostage, Paul Johnson, a 49-year-old Lockheed Martin employee. A hooded figure on the tape threatens to kill Johnson if jailed militants aren't released by Friday. Stocks showed little change today on Wall Street. The Dow lost a fraction to close at 10,379. The Nasdaq was up 2 to 1998. This is NPR News. Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry is promising more federal money for after-school programs for children. The Massachusetts senator visited a recreation center in Columbus, Ohio. Bill Cohen of Ohio Public Radio was there.
At 35 sites in Columbus, nearly 3,000 children from low-income families have someplace to go after school if their parents aren't home, rec centers, where they can get help with their homework, tutoring and reading, and even instruction on using computers. At this center, Kerry told a crowd of about 100 he'd pour federal dollars into these programs because they help mold children into good citizens. He added there are what he called selfisher reasons to back the special help.
You like paying for more prisons? You like paying for drug abuse? You like picking up the costs of chronic unemployment?
Kerry said the nation could pay for these programs and many others by canceling the federal income tax cut for the wealthy. Republicans have been charging that move wouldn't pay for all of Kerry's plans, and wiping out the tax cut would cripple the economic recovery. For NPR News, I'm Bill Cohen in Columbus.
The Southern Baptist Convention is calling for a federal amendment to ban same-sex marriage, but its leaders have rejected a resolution that would have urged Baptist parents to remove their children from public schools. At its yearly meeting, the group commended President Bush, who spoke to the delegates yesterday by satellite, asking their support for the constitutional ban on gay marriage. Other resolutions called on all Christians to register and vote in, quote, in accordance with biblical values. The Southern Baptist Convention is the nation's largest Protestant denomination, with more than 16 million members. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Robert Bryce, has written a new book called Cronies: Oil, the Bushes, and the Rise of Texas, America's Superstate. The book traces how Texas politicians and Texas corporations have taken leading roles in America's energy policy and foreign policy, including the war in Iraq. Bryce says this book grew out of the research for his first book, Pipe Dreams, Greed, Ego, and the Death of Enron. Bryce lives in Austin.
I think a lot of people are aware of the fact that the first President Bush, the second President Bush, Vice President Cheney, have all had connections to the energy business. They've all worked in the energy business. I did not know, perhaps a lot of other people did, but I did not know that James Baker, who was Secretary of State under the first President Bush and directed the Florida recount for the second President Bush, has also been very connected to the energy business and is a former Texan who was very close with George H.W. Bush even before he became president.
Well, and it's interesting to me because Baker, in terms of his power now as former Secretary of State, is perhaps the most powerful former Secretary of State in America. And his family's law firm, which he is now affiliated with, Baker Botts, has always represented the energy business in Texas. And before the energy business, the big railroads. And now Baker Botts represents ExxonMobil. They represent Occidental Petroleum. They represent ConocoPhillips. And Baker has all of these intertwining relationships with all of these different energy interests, while at the same time, President Bush has appointed him as the envoy to deal with Iraq's debt. So, you know, he's in this case, it seems to me, he's wearing a lot of hats, and we don't, in many cases, we don't know who he's representing.
Well, one of the companies that James Baker represents is Halliburton.
That's right. And in fact, before Halliburton went to Baker Botts, they were represented by Vinson and Elkins, which was another old-line Houston law firm, very powerful, very well-connected with the state's energy interests, and also was a key backer of Lyndon Johnson. And in 2002, after a lot of the Enron mess hit, Halliburton fired Vinson and Elkins and hired Baker Botts. And so, again, what is, you know, all these different relationships, when you start looking at them, you see, okay, well, there's a Baker Botts lawyer, a man named Robert Jordan, just stepped down as the U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia. We have Baker working on the issue of Iraq's debt, and we have Halliburton working in both countries very profitable contracts. And yet we can't find out what these lawyers are doing, who, you know, what they're representing, who they're talking to. And they're clearly not interested in discussing it.
How did James Baker and the first President Bush become close?
They met, according to all the sources that I can find, on the tennis courts at the Houston Country Club. They were met there, became social friends, and then became political allies. Baker was a key player in George H.W. Bush's first run for political office when he ran for the U.S. Senate in 1964. And now they've been friends for going on 50 years. And throughout, when you look at the history of both the older George Bush and the younger George Bush, Baker Botts, Baker's law firm, has continually played important roles. When the elder George Bush was in the energy business in Zapata, the law firm that represented them was Baker Botts. When George W. Bush had problems with the Securities and Exchange Commission, the law firm that represented him was Baker Botts. In fact, it was Robert Jordan, who then George W. Bush later appointed to be the U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia. When the Florida recount came around in 2000, again, it was Baker Botts. Baker became the lead player, but he also brought in key lawyers, key trial lawyers from Baker Botts, who then immediately went to Florida and argued several key cases that helped turn the tide for Bush.
When George H.W. Bush first entered politics and ran for the Senate in 1964, he was then chair of Zapata Offshore Oil Company, which is based in Houston. How much did his early campaigns rely on oil money?
Well, it was the key to his ability to even run for office. I interviewed former Texas Governor Bill Clements, who was also in the drilling business. In fact, Clements and George H.W. Bush were partners in energy ventures in the Persian Gulf, in Kuwait, and in Iran in the early 1960s. When I was interviewing Clements, I'd looked at some of the old campaign finance reports about Bush's funders for that 1964 race, and I saw that Clements had given him several tens of thousands of dollars. And I asked him about it, and he said, "Oh, no, I gave him way more than that." I said, "Well, how much did you give him?" He said, "I gave him $500,000. And I said, "Well, Governor, you realize that in today's money, that's $3.5 million. He says, "I know." But, you know, for him, it was just part of the being in the energy business, that he was a man with deep pockets, and he wanted someone who was going to go to Congress and protect the depletion allowance, who was going to look out for the Texas energy interests. And in 1966, when Bush won a seat in Congress, it's exactly what he did.
What were the energy interests at the time? What did the oil companies in Texas want?
Well, they wanted to make sure that the depletion allowance stayed in place. This was a special tax break that was only given to the energy producers that allowed them to take 27.5% of the income that they got off of a given well or wells and get all of that income tax-free. It was a tax break that was unique to the energy industry that Eastern interests and Democrats had been lobbying against for decades. Ever since it was passed in the early 1900s, and they fought it for years. They finally got it repealed in 1975, but throughout, particularly the 40s, 50s, 60s, and early 70s, the depletion allowance was a key factor in the ability of Texas energy interests to have huge amounts of disposable cash that they could then use to fund their favored politicians.
I think you're right. They were also interested in an oil import quota to protect Texas oil prices.
They were, and you know, now particularly, it's remarkable to look back at the import quota, because the issue now is, you know, we are so reliant on imported oil. Well, during the Nixon administration, George Bush the first was trying to make sure that imported oil was kept at bay, because he wanted to. This was another way to protect domestic energy producers. The Texas producers in particular, although their oil was abundant, they could not produce it as cheaply as oil that was coming from, say, Saudi Arabia or Kuwait or Venezuela. So in the 1950s, during the Eisenhower administration, they placed an import quota that restricted the amount of cheap imported oil that could be brought into the U.S., and that in effect, helped keep domestic prices up for domestic producers, and that was hugely important. And in fact, during the Nixon administration, there was much discussion of repealing this quota, and George Bush, the first, led the fight to keep the import quota in place.
George W. Bush was in the oil business before entering politics. Did his father's contacts help him get established in oil?
Oh, of course. I mean, I think this has been very well established, that when George W. Bush landed in Midland, one of the first things he did was go to his father's crony network and appeal to them for money that he could then use to begin drilling for oil in Arbusto and his other ventures, Harkin and so on. Those contacts that he had through his father and also through friends of James A. Baker III were key in his ability to raise the money that he needed to get going in the oil business.
Who were some of the Texas friends and businessmen who most helped him in his election campaign?
Well, Enron, the people from Enron, clearly figure throughout. When Bush began running for the U.S. or for the governorship of Texas, one of his first visits was to Houston, and there he talked to Rich Kinder, who was at that time the president of Enron. He was Jeff Skilling's predecessor at Enron. Bush went to Kinder and asked him if Kinder would be his finance chair in Harris County. Now, this is critically important because Houston is the biggest city in the state, and it is a huge source for political funds. Kinder was in the energy business. He was at Enron, which is a thriving company at that time in late 93, early 94. And Kinder agreed. And, you know, from that time then until I think just earlier this year, Enron was George W. Bush's biggest career patron. And they in total gave him something on the order of $700,000. And Texans for Public Justice has done studies on this and found that by far and away, the industry that gave the most money as a percentage of George W. Bush's total giving was the energy business.
I mean, should there be any surprise in that? I mean, after all, Texas is famous for its energy business, and all politicians rely on businesses in their state to help them rise in office.
Of course. But I think that now the energy business is the most important. It produces the most important commodity in the world economy. They are an expansionist business that by nature. They are always, you know, going into new markets. They are always expanding their businesses overseas. It is not in any way surprising that these companies would be supporting the Bushes and other conservative politicians. What is remarkable, I think, and very worthy of note, is how this universe of energy people is very small. And the key people who have been key players throughout the Bush family's rise in politics, like Ray Hunt, like James Baker, like personnel who are associated with Halliburton. It is a very small universe, and we keep seeing the same faces over and over. And I think it raises the question, well, where does business begin and where does politics begin? And I think what we see in many of these cases is simply that politics and business have merged, and I think that's dangerous.
My guest is Robert Bryce. He's the author of the new book, Cronies, Oil, the Bushes, and the Rise of Texas, America's Superstate. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Robert Bryce. His new book is called Cronies, Oil, the Bushes, and the Rise of Texas, America's Superstate. You, in talking about whether oil played a part in the decision to invade Iraq, you cite a report from 2001 that was put together by the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy at Rice University in conjunction with the Council on Foreign Relations. The report was titled Strategic Energy Policy Challenges for the 21st Century. What do you find most relevant about this report in looking ahead to the invasion of Iraq?
Well, I think what's remarkable about it is how similar some passages in that report are spot on with the agenda that was being promoted by the neocons, the neoconservatives. In specific, there was a passage in there that said that Saddam Hussein was a threat to the flow of oil to international markets. That passage is remarkable because other people that I talked to in the energy business were saying, well, no, he wasn't a threat. Yes, we knew he was abusing the UN oil for food program. We knew that he was withholding oil when it suited him. But the amount of oil that was being produced in Iraq at that time, you know, a million and a half barrels of oil a day, was not that significant in terms of overall world production. So it seemed to me, and the reason I brought that up was that one was the Baker affiliation, and the Baker Institute gets a huge amount of its funding from the energy business, but also that it was so in line with what the neocons were saying, particularly in terms of we've got to get rid of Saddam, we have to consider all of our military options, and so on.
Well, getting back to the question of whether the invasion of Iraq was connected to the oil industry or not, let's say hypothetically it was, and that the oil industry wanted to overthrow Saddam Hussein. What would they gain by that?
Well, I don't necessarily see it in those same terms. I think the issue is more about controlling the flow of oil. We don't want to own the oil. And I don't suggest that any of the oil companies, in fact, Lee Raymond, the CEO of Exxon, recently said that they're not interested in getting into Iraq now because the situation there is so unstable. The broader issue for the United States is being able to control the flow of oil out of the Persian Gulf. We don't need to own it. We just need to make sure that either the flow happens unimpeded, that there is no restriction on the flow of oil. So that's more the key issue. I don't think that there's some industry cabal where, you know, the big energy guy said we need to invade Iraq and take over the oil. I think it's simply a strategic issue for the United States over the long term to assert control or some authority over the oil that's in the Persian Gulf, because it is, as George H.W. Bush said in his 91 security directive, it is vital to U.S. national security. Our economy depends on that oil.
And isn't that an argument for saying perhaps that, you know, we're lucky there are so many oil industry people in the Bush administration, since oil is a security issue and these guys know the business, they will represent our security interests in knowing what is best for oil, and oil is in our security interest.
Fine, I take your point. But so let's call a spade then. Then let's stop talking about, you know, these other issues in terms of spreading democracy in the Mideast. Let's admit that we have a strategic interest there and we can't do anything about it. Or at the same time, if we can admit that and say publicly, yeah, we have to control this oil. We have to be concerned about the situation in Saudi Arabia, because if we aren't ready to invade, then our economy is going to be severely hurt. So what I guess I'm looking for is just some more truth in advertising here. If this is our strategic interest, let's admit it. And then furthermore, and I think most importantly, let's do something about our energy situation. Can we reduce this reliance on the Persian Gulf? Can we ameliorate it somehow with further efficiency or renewable efforts here in the U.S. or developing other sources? I mean, I think that this begs the question of, you know, can we really as a nation now face the facts in terms of what our interests are in the Persian Gulf? Because we're stuck now. We can't stay and we can't leave. And that's a bad place to be.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Bryce. He's the author of the new book, Cronies, Oil, the Bushes, and the Rise of Texas, America's Super State. What were some of the challenges you faced in researching this book, Cronyism, about oil and politics in Texas and how that's affected presidents like LBJ and the two President Bushes?
Well, I mean, the key one was access. You know, neither George H.W. Bush would talk to me. James A. Baker III refused my interview request, so I was forced to essentially, you know, ambush him in an interview and ask the few questions that I could. Generally, power people in power and people who have these kinds of relationships don't want to talk about them. They will, you know, generally only talk with, you know, journalists that they perceive will be, you know, very friendly to their interests, very friendly to their position. And, you know, I didn't go in there promising that I was going to soft pedal any questions. When I asked for an interview with George H.W. Bush, I made it very clear I wanted to talk with him about the Carlyle Group, and I wanted to talk with him about his involvement with business interests in Saudi Arabia. So I wasn't hiding at all what my agenda was or what my questions would be. And so, no, it's not surprising at all that they didn't want to talk.
How much investigation were you able to do into the Carlyle Group?
Well, the Carlyle Group to me is interesting, but it's not the evil empire. It's important because it is perhaps, you know, among these major investment banks, major venture capital firms, I guess, merchant banks, it is perhaps the best example of the cronyism that, you know, is now infesting our government. It is important. It's an important part of the story. But the part about the Carlyle Group that to me is interesting goes back to James Baker. That is that as Bush's debt envoy for Iraqi debt, Baker goes to Saudi Arabia to talk to the Saudis because the Saudis hold more Iraq debt than any other country. Baker had previously been to Saudi Arabia with the elder George Bush in an effort to raise money, investment funds from wealthy Saudis to invest in the Carlyle Group. And apparently they were successful because Prince Bandar and several other very prominent Saudis later invested in the Carlyle Group. Fast forward to, you know, recent months when Baker goes to Saudi Arabia to talk about the issue of debt. Well, who's he representing there? He's still working for the Carlyle Group. He's now representing talking to the Saudis about debt relief. But at the same time, we don't know what his own personal financial holdings are, because when Bush appointed him, he appointed him as a special governmental employee. And as such, Baker's financials, his personal financials, were not disclosed. And in fact, were only disclosed to the White House General Counsel's office. So he goes to Saudi Arabia wearing the hat of the U.S. government, maybe wearing the hat of the Carlyle Group, which does huge amounts of business in Saudi Arabia through United Defense, which is one of its subsidiaries. But again, we can't know what, you know, what are Baker's other interests while he's doing this job for George W. Bush.
Your previous book was about Enron and its collapse. How does that book and this book connect? You say in your introduction that this book grew out of writing that one.
Well, after finishing Pipe Dreams, I started thinking, well, what was it about Enron? Why did this company have so much political power? What was it that made it such an extraordinarily politically potent entity? And I puzzled over it for months, trying to think, okay, well, what is it that has made Texas powerful? What is it that has made Texas such a dominant player in American politics? And, you know, I just kept coming back to the energy slice of it, that, in fact, pretty much every Texas politician of note of the last 50 years has had major connections to the energy business. And so that was the genesis of it. Once I started puzzling over it and thinking, well, what about all these other industries? I realized Enron would never have been the powerhouse that it was had it been in the candy business or in something else. And it was in the energy business and it was in Houston. And those were key parts of its ability to wield power.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Robert Bryce is the author of Cronies, Oil, the Bushes, and the Rise of Texas, America's Superstate. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the Sundance Channel, presenting Soldier's Girl, based on a true story about gay love in the military, part of the Out Loud Film Fest on Sundance Channel tonight at 9. From Endless Pools, a treadmill for swimmers, allowing people to swim at home year-round, indoors or outside. DVD or video available at 877-ENDLESS. That's 877-ENDLESS or endlesspool.com. And by HBO, offering Band of Brothers on DVD. Produced by Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks, it is based on the true story of Easy Company in World War II. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, Bruce Eric Kaplan. He's a cartoonist for The New Yorker. He signs his work B.E.K. And he's an executive producer of 6 Feet Under. He has a new collection of cartoons. Also, Maureen Corrigan recommends a few novels to read this summer. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you're a fan of the cartoons in The New Yorker, you'll recognize my guest by the initials B.E.K. That's how Bruce Eric Kaplan signs his cartoons. His work has been featured in The New Yorker for over 10 years. Kaplan has also written for the TV shows Sybil, Seinfeld, and 6 Feet Under, where he's now an executive producer. This HBO series about a family that runs a funeral home had its season premiere Sunday. Kaplan has a new book called This Is a Bad Time. It collects his cartoons from The New Yorker and other publications, including the Boston Globe and LA Weekly. I asked Kaplan to describe one of the cartoons in the book.
This is a chicken talking to a bird in a farm set, in a barn-like setting, and the chicken's saying, "Sometimes I get so bored with myself, I can barely make it to doodle-doo."
No, where did that come? What made you think about that?
Oh, come on, please! Aren't you? Don't you get? You can't make it to doodle-doo some mornings.
But I
you?
Wouldn't have thought of the chicken. I just would have thought about myself.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, it's like a whole language, the world of cartoons. I mean, that there's images, classic ones, like the people crawling in the desert or the people on the deserted island. But, you know, there's a whole, is it lexicon? Is that using the word correctly?
Sure.
Of just images and worlds that you can sort of take your thoughts and plug them into. Like, a farm setting is a wonderful one, I think. I love farms. I love, not that I've ever been to one, but I love drawing them.
You mentioned desert. You have a great one of two people crawling across the desert.
Right.
Can you describe
it? Sure. It's a woman and man crawling in a desert, looking obviously starving and thirsty. And the woman turns to the man and says, "This isn't really about water. It's about what's going on between us," you know, as if they've been arguing.
Yeah. Now, how did you start drawing cartoons? What made you think, this is something I can do?
I just always drew little people. Like, you know, when I was talking on the phone or when I was drawing, I mean, when I was watching TV, I would always draw little people, little men and little women, you know, going about their business. I actually think some holding cocktail glasses the way that I still do for New Yorker cartoons. I mean, I always loved The New Yorker, so I'm sure that it was very... and I loved New Yorker cartoons when I was very little and would get, you know, the anthologies or whatever they're called out of the library or collections. So I think it was in my head that as an option, you know, as something that was out there that I could do and I like to draw.
Who were the cartoonists who you loved the most when you were a kid looking at this?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I love them all. I don't remember ever not loving one, to tell you the truth. I mean, they're just, you know, the one, I was very passionate about Charles Adams. I was definitely, like, very Charles Adams focused as a child and would, you know, take his stuff out of the library constantly, you know, all the time. I just said this the other day, so when I was taking out his books, like, all the time from the library, like, you know, every 2 weeks, I don't know why someone just didn't give me one, but they didn't.
What came first, writing for television or cartooning?
They actually came at the same time. What happened was I had been trying to write for television and not succeeding at it, and I thought, like, oh, I don't remember how it came to me, but I thought, like, I could be a New Yorker cartoonist. I mean, one day it was just like, yes, that I could do. You know, I'm not succeeding at this other thing, but this one I can do, so I, like, you know, read in the library, like, I got a book out, How to Be a Cartoonist, and it said there was an art meeting once a week, and I started submitting, you know, I did 10 drawings and sent them off with a self-addressed envelope, like the book in the library told me to do, and I was, you know, of course, like everything I did at the time, I was sure they were going to buy all 10 drawings, and I just sat there in my apartment, and I, you know, drew my next group so I wouldn't miss next week's meeting, and sent that off, and then my first envelope came back with a rejection letter, and I was so shocked. I couldn't believe it. It was this form rejection letter. I thought, like, you know, I'd sent them these brilliant things, I thought. And so I just, you know, assumed they had made a mistake on some level and that they were going to buy some of the second group. So I started working on my third group, and then, you know, of course, needless to say, I got my envelope back, the second group, and... Anyhow, it was a compulsion by this time, and I actually spent a few years sending, you know, 10, 15, 20 cartoons every week. I never missed an art meeting for a few years. And so now I was also concurrently trying to be a sitcom writer and failing at both. So now I had instead of, you know, the New Yorker cartoons were supposed to be like this easy way into like a wonderful life, and yet it was now just another thing that I was not succeeding at. But I was very compulsive, for lack of a better word. I had to do it. So then a few years into it, my friend Kenny had hired me for the Emmy Awards, and I came back from work one day, and instead of my self-addressed envelope, there was a FedEx from the New Yorker, and I just cried. I mean, because I knew something was happening, obviously, and I opened it up, and it was an acceptance letter, you know, and it was such a big deal. It was just like I would get these little tiny, they're not even 8.5 by 11, they're like note card rejection letters that are no signature. It was like sending these off into a void. So the idea that finally someone, you know, had read them. I mean, I would write cover letters that said, like, cursing at them, saying, here are, you know, 10 bleeping cartoons that any other bleeping magazine would publish except for you. Because I figured it didn't feel like anyone was actually reading these cartoons. It just felt like they would open them up and put them in my self-addressed envelope and send them back to me. When I got the FedEx, the first line was, I know you think we haven't been reading your stuff. But we have, and here are these cartoons. We'd like you to draw, you know, revise them. And then that led to a new world of horror, because revising, I thought I was drawing these perfect things. I had no idea I was supposed to be revising these images.
What kind of revisions did they ask for?
Oh, God, it's embarrassing now, but I mean, he said, you know, I had no idea. I really did, you know, this is how I was in my 20s. I thought, these are perfect. So I called him up. It was Lee Lorenz, the art editor at the time, and I said, like, hi, I'm Bruce Kaplan. I'm excited to do these revisions, but what should I change? And he said, like, well, you see the table in that picture? It doesn't look like a table. You know, a table should have four legs. It was like that type of thing. So he would tell me, you know, things in my drawings that just really weren't cutting it.
Now, here's what confuses me. You don't seem like somebody who's brimming over with confidence. And yet, you had the confidence in these cartoons, and you thought, like, hey, any self-respecting magazine would be accepting these cartoons and publishing them.
I know. I wish. Believe me. Tell me what this is in my psyche, and you know, it saved me a lot of money. I don't have the answer for that. I do. It's like a split kind of two, you know, a duality of, I'm wildly confident and then also wildly not secure.
Here's a cartoon that I figure relates to writing in some way. Someone's driving in a car along a big deserted strip of highway and passes a billboard, and the billboard says, your own tedious thoughts next 200 miles. And I don't know. To me, that's not only about just kind of having to be alone for a long time on a deserted highway or alone any place like that. I just have a feeling, too, that for you as a writer, maybe it feels that way sometimes, that you have a dry spell and, like,
it's never not a dry spell for me. I'm one of those writers who, you know, moans in agony, or cartoonists constantly, you know, why are there no good ideas? You know, I despise myself. It's always the same thought going on in my head. Oh, so yes, it's completely autobiographical about writing and the creative process.
So what do you do to kind of break the dry spell when you're feeling that way? Sit there and hope for the best.
For me, it's more than hoping. I've tried everything. I mean, I've prayed, I've cried, I've, you know, kicked. But, you know, it's actually just going through that emotion to the next emotion of, well, I'm going to produce something. I'm going to write something. I'm going to draw something. And what do I want it to be? What is interesting to me? Sometimes also it helps to go through the negative emotions in terms of, like, to do a drawing about hating oneself or about, you know, not having any ideas. And maybe that drawing will be great or not, but then it'll be exercised a little bit, and then you'll think about something else that's on your mind, and that will, you know, you'll move forward. I mean, gradually, it's always like a trick to just lose yourself in the process. And if you have faith, then you can. That's my opinion.
My guest is Bruce Eric Kaplan. He has a new collection of cartoons called This Is a Bad Time. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is Bruce Eric Kaplan, who has been cartooning for The New Yorker for over 10 years. He signs his cartoons B.E.K. His cartoons are collected in the new book, This is a Bad Time. Kaplan is also an executive producer of the HBO series 6 Feet Under.
You've been working on 6 Feet Under since the very beginning of the series, since the pilot. One of your more famous episodes is the foot episode, and in this one, in the opening death, I think it's a baker is killed in some of the baking technology, and his body's mangled. And you want to describe what happens with the foot?
Yeah, I mean, the baker dies in a dough mixer, I believe, and he's, you know, his body is chopped up into different parts, and later in the episode, Claire is in the funeral home talking to Nate, and she steals a foot from, I mean, she's in the prep room talking to Nate, and she steals the foot of this man, Mr. Romano.
And she puts it in her boyfriend's locker.
She's mad at him because, she sucked his toes and he told the school about it.
So it's a kind of gruesome, it's not treated gruesomely, it's kind of an absurdist touch, but right. it could be very gruesome. Whose idea was that?
That was Alan's idea. Sorry not to have that be my idea again. But, yeah, I remember, Alan, this was, the third episode of the series, and I remember we were talking about stories for future episodes before the first one actually shot, and he came in one morning and said, what if Claire stole a foot? And, the second he said it, it's like, yes, Claire must steal a foot, and I definitely will write that episode because that's something I understand stealing a foot.
How can you understand stealing a foot?
I don't know. I haven't done it yet. But I understand the emotion behind stealing a foot and making and feeling like they wanting to make a statement with it. I just understand the sort of the operaticness of that. I connect with that.
Have you been to any funerals since you started working on the series?
Sure. Sadly, yes.
I'm wondering if writing the series kind of affects what it's like for you when you're at a funeral. I mean, not the grief itself, but just watching how the actual ceremony unfolds. Maybe it's a stupid question because you'd be much too absorbed in grief to even think about that.
No, because it's like anything in life. I'm not never too absorbed in any activity of, unfortunately.
To stop thinking.
That I can also, yeah, exactly. Right. I wish. Please, give me that activity and I'll take it all day long. It's definitely, I have a more process-oriented eye now, that this person is doing that. That's how the reality of eulogies is different than the eulogies on 6 Feet Under, I feel sometimes. I can't quite, I'd love for them to be the same, but I can't quite tell you why my experience of the reality of eulogies in real life is different. Maybe it's just because, again, it's just real life versus, drama.
Now, I think we've established that you have your own share of neuroses. Now, you used to write for Seinfeld,
mm-hmm.
which, so much of the show was about each of the characters, neuroses and issues. And then I think, Larry David is the co-creator and was the head writer. And certainly, his persona on his own show on HBO is somebody who is just so incredibly neurotic and self-absorbed and unempathetic. mm-hmm. And then there's
funny to hear you describe it because it's like I have such a different experience of it.
That's what I want to hear.
Sure. For both Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm, I think, I think oh, God, these are such fully developed human, real people.
Right.
Never could put it in terms of neuroses or that type of thing because to me it's just they're people. They're just, people who, and in their fully naked or, they're exposed. And this is sort of, they're vain and they're funny and they're interested and they're not interested and they're, sort of greedy, but they're also altruistic, I guess, sometimes. They are, So it just seems like people in their full regalia, whatever that is.
Right, right, naked and in their full regalia.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So, but what was it like working on Seinfeld with what must have been a pretty interesting and maybe combustible mix of personalities? Because you got Larry David, then you got Jerry Seinfeld, and, you know, just watching him.
Oh, this is a factual one. I can correct you on this. I worked on the final season of
Seinfeld.
So Larry David
was already gone.
Yeah, he came to do the final episode, but he wasn't really there for the bulk of the year. So.
Well, the final series of Seinfeld, I mean, the final season of Seinfeld, by that time, you know, Seinfeld started as a show that was, quote, about nothing. It was just about, like, mm-hmm. little day-to-day things in life, you know, shopping for an air conditioner and losing your car in the shopping mall, not being able to find it, that kind of thing. By the end, the stories were really kind of extravagantly impossible. How did you feel about writing for that end of the series when it was no longer a show about the little details in life as much as it was about these really improbable things happening to all the characters?
Again, this wasn't my experience of it. I mean, it definitely, the show became more stylized in the final two seasons, and the stories kept getting bigger and bigger. But at the same time, they were very rooted in real sort of emotions. Like I mean, one of the ones I wrote was about Elaine getting frustrated because she doesn't understand a New Yorker cartoon, which is, you know, it's a very natural thing that happens to people, I believe. Or, you know, in another episode I wrote, she was upset by someone at work who, you know, sidled up too close to her, and she didn't enjoy that. So I think they were grounded in reality things. They sort of then, by the end of the second act, just really ballooned. But it was fun. I enjoyed it.
In the episode where Elaine is confused about the meaning of a New Yorker cartoon, does she also try to become a cartoonist in that?
Yes. In the second act, she decides that, like, that, you know, if they could, if this is what they're publishing, and then she could definitely do a better job. And she comes up with one, and it ends up, you know, they buy it and they publish it, and it ends up being a cartoon that she unconsciously ripped off from a Ziggy cartoon.
Do you remember the cartoon?
Yeah, Ziggy's at the complaint department, and he's saying, "I have a complaint. I wish I were taller," something like that. That's the bad cartoon, everybody. I hope everyone knows that.
Oh, okay.
It was the cartoon, you know, the whole gang, like, you know, George and Jerry and Kramer. No one can believe that she thinks this is funny, you know. And Kramer is like, it would be much funnier if he was saying, "My wife is a slut." I don't know. You had to be there.
So it wasn't a real Ziggy cartoon? You made this one up?
Oh, no. Yeah, it was a false Ziggy. Yes, we created our own Ziggy for that episode.
I'm going to get back to another cartoon. And this one is of a couple in bed. And one of them is saying to the other, "I don't understand how people with full lives do it."
That, right, I know. That. I feel the same way.
What inspired that?
I remember thinking it. I remember thinking about these two people. I mean, it was just, I don't know how they do it. I don't, you know, they have a full life. How is it possible? I mean, again, this is one of those where it's true. It's I know on some level it's funny, but hearing you say it, it's like in the moment, it's not. How do they do it? Please, I want the answer.
One final question. When mm-hmm. When you sign your cartoons, your name is Bruce Eric Kaplan, but you sign them B-E-K, and each of those initials is boxed. And so
yes.
The boxes are adjoining. Mm-hmm. Did I describe that okay?
Yes, beautifully.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
How did you, two things, why do you use your middle name, Eric, and how did you come up with your signature?
Okay, first thing, the first answer, I remember feeling like that Bruce Kaplan wasn't enough. It had to be my whole name, Bruce Eric Kaplan. Like, I just felt like that's who I am creatively. I am my whole name, but whatever that means. And then, but the second is, how did I come up with the boxes?
Mm-hmm.
I tried, I think, in the early days of doing the cartoons, just doing the signature, and it just felt like it was... Everything was wrong, the script and how long it was and how much space it took up and just the script, it just didn't look right with this, you know, world that I have. And I remember playing around with things and coming up with the B-E-K because this felt like, oh, yes, this is a part of this world, the B-E-K.
Well, Well, Bruce Eric Kaplan, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Bruce Eric Kaplan is a cartoonist for The New Yorker. His new collection of cartoons is called This Is a Bad Time. Kaplan is also an executive producer of the HBO series 6 Feet Under, which had its season premiere on Sunday. Coming up, book critic Maureen Corrigan recommends novels for summer reading. This is Fresh Air. Depending on your mood, you could decide to be entertained, haunted, and/or enlightened by some of this summer's standout novels. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a roundup of 3 new books.
Summer is the season when publishers put out literary novels by award-winning mid-list writers whose voices might be drowned out in the fanfare of fall blockbusters. It's also the season when publishers take calculated risks on unknown authors with a gimmick. And the gamble has certainly paid off in the case of The Rule of Four, a thriller co-written by 2 friends in their 20s named Ian Caldwell and Dustin Thomason. The Rule of Four has been hyped on the front page of the New York Times, no less, as this summer's suspense novel for smarties, in the tradition of The Da Vinci Code and The Name of the Rose. The novel's Crack the Linguistic Code plot focuses on an arcane Renaissance text called the Hypnerotomachia. It's an actual brain teaser of a book written in 7 languages and illustrated with nightmarish woodcuts that was published anonymously in 1499 in Venice. The very clever conceit of The Rule of Four is to have a Princeton student named Paul Harris writing his senior thesis on the Hypnerotomachia. When the novel opens, Paul's thesis is due in 24 hours, and as he and a roommate get closer to solving the text's central riddle, betrayals and dead bodies begin mounting. The Rule of Four uses Princeton's Gothic campus to eerie effect, and it has some astute comments to make about ambitious scholars who start off wanting to serve books and end up wanting books to serve them and their careers. Just don't be misled by the academic trappings. The Rule of Four is pure summer diversion. You won't get course credit for reading it. The young losers who populate Dan Shaun's new novel, You Remind Me of Me, wouldn't have a prayer of being accepted into the likes of Princeton. There's an apathetic teenaged mother named Nora who gives up her first baby for adoption and keeps the second only to grievously ignore him. That boy winds up having his face chewed apart by the family's pet Doberman. Another boy named Troy grows up to become a minor league drug dealer, but he's known enough parental love to feel fatherly concern for his own neglected son. Sean's Midwestern drifters in training are limited, but not necessarily doomed by their personalities and circumstances. One of the most captivating aspects of this novel is the way it zeroes in on the inherited weaknesses, the small stores of ambition, the pivotal moments of cruelty or accidental mercy that will eventually determine who sinks or swims. Sean is known for his award-winning collections of short stories, like Among the Missing. You Remind Me of Me, his debut novel, works like a bunch of short stories, especially at first, when he's establishing the different plot strands and timelines before crisscrossing them together. Comparisons to the work of the immortal Raymond Carver abound, beginning with the tossed-off title of Sean's novel and continuing through with his tone of Lost in America melancholy. Like Carver, Sean makes forgettable nobodies unforgettable. not by ladling on the schmaltz, but through the stark alertness of his language. Speaking of comparisons, in his new novel, The Master, Colm Tobin gives an enhanced imitation of his subject, Henry James. I dare to say enhanced because Tobin explores the older James's regrets and lifelong sexual uncertainties in elegant sentences that contain all the complexity of James's, but avoid the, hey, look at me, marathon contortions often found in the originals. The Master explores James's interior and public life throughout the 1890s when he was living in England. It's the decade of James's horrific artistic failure, the play Guy Domville, that was booed at its London debut, while those of his rival, Oscar Wilde, were cheered. Tobin's omniscient narrator says that, after the failure of Guy Domville, James's determination to work did battle with the feeling that he had been defeated and exposed. He had failed, he realized, to take the measure of the great flat foot of the public. James here tentatively confronts the shades of dead family and friends whom he disappointed, like his sister Alice, a lifelong invalid. His solitude is also disturbed by society matrons with skin like bottled fruit, self-important friends like Oliver Wendell Holmes, so adept at finishing their sentences, and handsome young men who stir up the love that dare not speak its name. The Master, however, does something even more extraordinary than treating its readers to this gorgeously evocative language or to an imagined life of James himself. It illuminates the creative process, slowly tracking how bits and pieces of images, voices, memories, and moods perhaps coalesced into The Turn of the Screw or Portrait of a Lady. The Rule of Four may be a fun puzzle of a novel about a cryptic book, but The Master probes a more absorbing mystery, the mystery of how great books happen, and in so doing, it becomes a great book itself.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Rule of Four, You Remind Me of Me, and The Master. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Chirac. Our engineers are Bob Purdick and Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. And from Bantam Books, publisher of Bad Move, a comic mystery that proves that life in the suburbs can be murder, by Linwood Barclay, new in hardcover. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Yossi Beilon, the leader of Israel's Social Democratic Party, talks about negotiating with Palestinians for a Middle East peace after others have given up. Beilon was an initiator of the Oslo peace talks and the Geneva Accord. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.